Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, a couple of topics today. One, I want to revisit this idea going around that, neoliberalism is on its last legs. And that it's pretty much crashing, and neoliberal policies are on the way out. We need to look at that in relationship to what the Biden administration has been doing and is doing. So that's the main topic today. I want to talk about this idea whether neoliberalism's on its last legs or not. In some ways, we'll see that it's being increasingly challenged and it is failing in some ways, certainly not on its last legs yet. So we're going to talk about that in relationship, neoliberalism in relationship to the Biden administration. We've talked a lot about in previous shows about neoliberalism in general. We've looked at its whole history from the late 70s through all the regimes here. We've looked at its major elements. It's essentially an economic policy regime that aims at a class dominance. It has two focuses. One is to keep down the working class and social movements, maintain domestic hegemony here for capital, and also an international intra-capitalist class focus, maintain U.S. capitalist hegemony globally with its competitors and adversaries and even allies. Okay, so it's a class-based policy, and both a domestic and a global focus to it. So we will come to that. But first, I want to talk about two other topics here that are worth discussing this week. Very timely. One, just today, that's the student loan decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, a 6-3 decision. Big surprise. We knew this was coming. But what does this really represent? Well, first of all, a little comparison here. Student loans, okay? How many student loans are we talking about in the U.S.? There's 43.5 million student loans, or students with loans, right? And Biden's student loan decision or proposal would have eliminated 10,000 to 20,000, depending on the type of loan, for a subset of those 43.5 million. It was mostly lower income students would be relieved, especially if they got the extra 10,000. It amounted to, over the time it was implemented here, about $400 billion. Okay, the Supreme Court decided, no, you can't do that. The president can't do that. No executive orders are allowable to expunge student loan debt. And what are we talking about, total debt? We're talking about close to $2 trillion of debt. There's when you include graduate student debt and private student loans here, parent student loans, et cetera, and then the Department of Education loans, we're looking at about $1.9 or $2 trillion. Well, Biden would have forgiven $400 billion of that, still leaving over $1.5 trillion in debt for students. And of course, we know this decision is coming congruent with the decision in this debt ceiling deal, and Republicans and Democrats agreed to resume student loan payments here September 1st. So it's a double whammy for students, no exemption at all, and resumption of loan payments here And there's a proposal in Congress that will certainly pass the House. I don't know if it gets through the Senate, that will add to existing student loan debt all the unpaid interest that was forbeared. In other words, during COVID until September 1st, students did not have to pay their student loans. They were like suspended, and no interest would accrue on that. But now there's an act going through Congress that would impose interest for the 2+ years onto the principal. So big whammy. In other words, not only will student debt resume if this law passes, but it will mean a big increase in the payments, because the interest payments for 2.5 years would be added to your principal, which would increase your monthly payments. So student 43 million people are really getting whacked here. It's a bigger picture than just exempting lower income, some lower income, 10 to 20,000 in loans. It's a bigger picture because everyone's going to start paying, and you may have to pay even more. Okay. And of course, this is all going to have a big, big whack to consumption here at a time consumption, 2/3 of the economy is already slowing dramatically here. But that's another analysis for the economy for another day here. But the point is 43 million are going to start paying, and none of them will get any exemption, and they may even have to pay more. Compare that to the PPP loan forgiveness for small business, you know, payroll protection program. Remember that during COVID? Small businesses were given loans. Well, how many of them got loans? 34.9 million. Small businesses got PPP loans. Some of the not so small were scamming it, so they got the loans too. And how many of those 34.9 million will be, quote, forgiven? 24.8 million of small businesses are forgiven already their PPP loans. Now compare that to the students. 43.5 million students, not a forgiven. 24.8 small businesses, totally forgiven. In other words, their loans are converted to grants. And, oh, that's not an issue with the Supreme Court. Oh, no, you can forgive 25 million businesses. That's not a problem, but you can't forgive a lesser amount of students any of their debt. I mean, think about that. I mean, isn't this a class-based capitalist Supreme Court? They do nothing about 25 million businesses. Totally exempt. Now, how much are we talking about? We're talking about $900 billion in PPP loans were given out, a little more than $900 billion. Averaging, the loans average between $72,000 and $95,000. Between $72,000 and $95,000. Not $10,000 or $20,000. About $80,000, $85,000 on average. Loans totally forgiven. $25 million of loans. $85,000 forgiven for businesses, but nada for students. Nada. Think about that. I mean, it really shows you the class-based system we have here and the courts. So they say, oh, the Supreme Court is independent, right? Yeah. Sure. They're not political. Sure. I mean, this guy Roberts, who's the Chief Justice, he's a corporate lawyer before he got his position on the Supreme Court. Some key questions about student loans we ought to ask ourselves, too. Why are kids charged interest rates on their student loans greater by the government, greater than the banks charge students interest on their loans? You know, there's this arrangement that you can take your education department loans every year. You get a different loan, and you can consolidate them with a private bank at a lower interest rate than the government was charging you. Why is the government charging, and it will be charging 5 to 7% here, the rates go up in another week or so, in early July. If you're a graduate or a professional, you know, you're going to pay closer to 7% than if you're an undergraduate. So 5 to 7%. I think that it's now it's like four something and five something. Well, that's going up to 5 to 7%. Yeah. Why does the government charge on its loans more than the private banks do when you consolidate? Well, because that's the way it's set up. The law, you know, the arrangement, the program, wants to push you into the private banking system where they collect the interest. By the way, if you're a corporation or a bank, you can go to the Federal Reserve and borrow at 3 to 4% now. Yeah. Why do banks get to borrow from the government at 3% on 10-year treasuries, for example, and students have to pay 5 to 7%, double that, for their loans? Again, another example. If you're a capitalist in a corporation, in a business, whatever, you get really preferential treatment under this system, whether it's the executive, legislative branch, or the Supreme Court. Why is it that corporations can file bankruptcy for debt, but students can't? Oh, then when they pass the student loan deal, and under George W. Bush, they passed laws anticipating large debt increase. They passed laws that said students cannot file bankruptcy over their debt, student loan debt. No, you're precluded from doing that. Oh, but businesses can. In fact, the laws that were passed under Bush made it easier for businesses to declare bankruptcy. You know, when you declare bankruptcy, you get out from under a lot of your debt. Your debt gets restructured. Some of it gets thrown out, whatever. So students can't file bankruptcy, but businesses can. Mm-hmm. And the question is, why are the banks so opposed to what our government education loans, and thus the forgiveness of those loans? Why are the banks opposed? Well, part of it is, as I said, you know, the consolidation. There was, you know, if you forgive the loans, there's no need to consolidate them with private banks at an interest rate where the banks would get interest income from them, right? I mean, it's a golden goose for the banks here. Education 1.9 trillion, $2 trillion. It's a golden goose, you know, guaranteed income flowing in. You can't wipe it out. You can't declare bankruptcy, right? Also, you got to realize when the government issues an education loan, what does it do? In many cases, not all cases, but it turns around and it sells those loans to guess who? The banks. And the banks collect the interest. So the bankers have their claws into the $2 trillion student loan pie, and they don't want to give it up. And that's why they are absolutely opposed, and their lobbyists are more influential than yours, to any student loan forgiveness, and the Supreme Court is lockstep behind them. Now, there's also a point to keep in mind here, and that this is a very bad precedent created by the Supreme Court. Think about it. You know, there was a big issue here when the challenge was brought to this student loan exemption idea. By the way, I think it was brought by a Missouri student loan lender here, right? There was a big question whether there was standing. What is standing? Standing is this legal term in the courts that the court will only hear your case if the court believes that you are being harmed by this law in some way. You know, if you can't show you're being harmed or damaged by something, you can't take a matter to court. You'll be rejected based on you lack standing. Well, the court recognized or decided that this Missouri lender had, quote, standing. Oh, the Missouri lender said, oh, if you forgive student loans, it's going to affect my profit from interest. Yeah. Well, think about that. If they give, and they have, SCOTUS gives this Missouri lender standing to hear this case that they've just decided on, what should stop the precedent from spreading? Any business can now, because you've got a precedent, can now decide to challenge a government executive order or a government program and take it to the Supreme Court if its profits are affected by the law or by the decision, by the program or whatever. They can do the same thing with any law that they want now. Very flimsy basis for standing here because, look, how can you separate out whether student loan forgiveness is going to have a significant impact on bank or lenders' profits when there's so many other factors affecting profits, costs, and so forth? How can you, you know, it's very hard to distinguish how much is due to, how much impact on the profits is due to student loan forgiveness and how much is not. Well, you see, when the courts, the capitalist courts, want to find a justification for a decision they've already made in their mind, you know, they can do, you know, their legal ledger domain here and find a justification and craft the justification, do their wordsmithing, you know, and they find a justification. And we've got a very serious situation with this student loan forgiveness in terms of a precedent-setting decision, not just screwing students and student loan at a time when they're going to have to resume payments and maybe even be liable for back interest for 2.5 years. Yeah. I mean, it's capitalist interest running amok here. And the institutions of the government are leaning on people in a severe way as never before, right? Okay, so that's my comment about this student loan forgiveness. And it's, you know, just remember the statistics. PPP loans, small business, $34.9 million, $900 billion, $24.8 million have been forgiven, averaging about $80,000-$85,000 versus 43 million students, 400 billion, not even half of the PPP forgiveness, right? Nothing forgiven. I think the average student loan is somewhere around 30,000. Okay. So one third the size of PPP loans, less than half of the PPP forgiveness, and, the businesses get the deal, and the students get the shaft. Okay, enough on that. Moving on, another topic I want to talk about this past week before we get to this neoliberal theme is the Ukraine war and Prigozhin's rebellion. You know this guy Prigozhin, who is private oligarch, Russian capitalist who has this private army and called Wagner. It's the sort of mercenaries, Russia's own mercenaries, you know, just like we have Blackwater? Yeah, Blackwater puts together mercenaries for the U.S. military. Played a big role in the Middle East. You know, you don't hear much about Blackwater, but played a big role. Well, you know, all the big players have their mercenary armies, because if you have a mercenary group, you can undertake what is de facto military action without having to say, well, the state, the government's at war. Right. So it's a backdoor to war without having to declare it or whatever. Okay. So Prigozhin is this guy, this oligarch that was close to Putin here, made his millions selling hot dogs. Yeah, well, maybe that's an extreme, but, you know, he did have hot dog stands. But he was a restaurateur, see, and in the past becomes friendly with Putin. And he goes into business of the mercenary military business here. And he creates this Wagner group of mercenaries, professionals, you know, former military guys who just love to, you know, continue running around with their AK-47s or M16s, whatever. He paid them fairly well. He had this professional group, professional military group, and, you know, he was doing some of the tasks for the Russians in Africa and so forth, right? So Prigozhin, here last week, institutes a rebellion with his Wagner group, and he marches on Moscow, or he tried to. He got part of the way to Moscow, a rebellion within the Russian military, right in the middle of a war. What's really behind this? Well, if you listen to the propaganda media in the West, you know, it's, he was really abused by the military, and the military, Russian military, wouldn't give him ammunition, and the Russian military treated him and his group, who were very good fighters. You know, they conquered the city Bakhmut in the Donbass, Ukraine area here in the middle of the war, all by themselves. Right? He did it. Wagner did it. And what did they get for it? Well, they, this is according to the Western media, of course, they got, he got shit on here by the Russian Ministry of Defense. You know, it's equivalent of the Defense Department in the U.S., the Pentagon, Ministry of Defense, the Russian Pentagon, right? That's the story. And, he responded here to this abuse by the MOD, Ministry of Defense, by taking his loyal forces and marching towards Moscow. Now, as it turned out, he never got to Moscow. A deal was cut in which the president of nearby Belarus mediated before there was a big battle outside of Moscow. You know, we're talking about maybe a couple thousand troops here, Wagner troops. Not all of Wagner participated in the march. You know, maybe about a third of them, those especially loyal to Prigozhin, right? Before they actually reached Moscow, a deal was struck, mediated by Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, right, that said, okay, all right, let's avoid bloodshed here. If you want, you can come, you, Prigozhin, can come to Belarus, right? Because this was treason, obviously. Putin quickly said, once the march began, that they would be prosecuted, you know, in no uncertain terms. And Putin let it stand for now to let Prigozhin go to Belarus, and any of the Wagner fighters could join him, you know, or they could join the Russian military or just go home, right? That's the compromise. And that's all you're going to hear in the Western media. But there's another story that's beginning to come to light here, and that is, over the past year, from March, February, March, you know, when the Ukraine war began here in earnest, Wagner, his forces, which is about a division size, maybe 20,000 total at its peak, Wagner was being paid, Prigozhin was being paid almost $1 billion for his services. Almost $1 billion, I think $950 million or something like that, in Russian currency, which would have been like $3-4 billion here in dollars. He was also paid almost the same amount for his food restaurant company delivering supplies. So Prigozhin makes almost $2 billion in 1 year, paid for by the Ministry of Defense. A nice business, right? War is good business. He's a capitalist. He's an oligarch. He figures this new business model that he launches of mercenary forces, he's doing quite well. But then what happens? What happens is his contract was up for renewal on May 1st, but the Ministry of Defense did not renew it. In other words, the Ministry of Defense decided they no longer needed Wagner services. We'll discuss why shortly, okay? And the Ministry of Defense turns around and offers the Wagner fighters individual contracts to fight with the Russian army. So the contracts with Prigozhin, they had the fighters with Prigozhin, are null and void. They don't exist anymore. That means Prigozhin isn't going to get paid for them. And the Ministry of Defense says, oh, come and join, and we'll pay you even more. In other words, they were squeezing him out well before his rebellion. As a good capitalist, of course, he reacted to that, right? Now, there's also evidence that Prigozhin may have been, I don't know how true this is, may have been in contact with CIA and UK intelligence services in Africa, where Wagner forces are engaged, right? It's coming out now that he had some conversations with them. And, you know, it's interesting that in the last couple weeks, the UK press was talking about, oh, a rebellion is coming by Wagner. Well, how the hell did they know that this was going to happen? You know, there's some interesting connections here. Now, the way the Western media explains that Wagner and Prigozhin pull out of gas, and they march on this. First, they march on this Russian city, Rostov-on-Don, which is the military center for southern Russia, right? And without a fight, they take over the city in Rostov-on-Don, and then from there, they start their march north to Moscow. Well, that's not what happened. Weeks before, once the Battle of Bakhmut was over, in fact, even before it was over, Wagner was pulled out of Bakhmut, and the Russian army took over here and has really been running the show in the final conquest of that city. The Wagner group was sent to their camp, which is just outside of Rostov-on-Don. So they didn't march on Rostov-on-Don. They were sent there weeks before. And, of course, from there, they marched north, some of them. So, you know, it looks to me like a desperate move by Prigozhin. His contract, his money was all cut off. He was pissed off, of course. And, you know, he's been rattling the cage here for weeks, really bad-mouthing the Russian military leaders, you know. Well, this is all after his contract was cut off, you know. And he expresses it, oh, you know, they're not giving us ammunition and so on and so forth, right? Well, they cut off his contract. Yeah. So it looks to me like Prigozhin and desperate capitalist fashion tries to save his business, and he marches on Rome to force a new deal. Well, of course, he got a new deal. The new deal was he goes to Belarus, and he keeps his whatever money he's made over the past year. Who knows where that money is? It's probably in Western banks. Reportedly, some of it's in St. Petersburg, but I bet you it's in Swiss banks as well. And I'm sure the West knows where his money is. And if they were in contact with him, you know, they were offering him and threatening him, you know, that he would have his money seized. And, you know, he's worried about that, no doubt. I mean, this is the problem when you got capitalists running military operations. Now, it's very dangerous. Blackwater is very dangerous. So is the Wagner Group, right? He's just an oligarch trying to prevent bankruptcy here, right? Now, why was Wagner de-emphasized? Okay. Well, I think because the Russian strategy in 23 has shifted from what were perhaps offensive operations trying to gain ground to a deep defensive strategy. In other words, they dug in, they mobilized here. If you remember over the winter, they mobilized because they were under-mobilized here last fall. And that's why they lost the Kharkov region to the Ukrainian second offensive. And they mobilized, but they didn't mobilize to launch Russia, to launch a new offensive. They mobilized to deepen and strengthen their defensive positions. And that's just what they've done. You know, when you had this first invasion, you know, Russia only had 190,000 troops, maybe 100,000 of those were actually combat troops spread across four major offensive areas, you know, around Kiev, Kharkov, the Donbass, and Kherson in the south. Well, that's like a division in each of those areas. And I think the Russians initially thought that, you know, the Ukraine, with that show of force, Ukraine would come to the table and negotiate a deal. Well, they did. The Western media does not report what actually happened in April of last year. Well, what happened was the Ukrainians sat down with the Russians in Istanbul, and they signed a deal. They signed a deal. And that deal has been publicized. The Russians have publicized that deal. But what happened was quickly the West jumped in and prevented and the deal and reversed it and got Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, to say, no, there's no deal. This was all happened last April with the first Russian offensive, which is really a show of force. You know, they never could have taken Kiev with, you know, maybe 20,000 you know, troops. There's no way they could take Kiev. You know, to take a major city, you need a 10-to-1 advantage in numbers to take a major city. Well, they had no advantage in numbers. That was a show of force to intimidate Ukraine to come to the table. And they did come to the table. They did sign a deal. But Boris Johnson rushes in at the time and makes Zelensky turn around. And we know ever since then there's no chance of any deal going on. Well, that's the reality. That's the fact. And Russia was outnumbered once over the summer last year. The U.S. and NATO, the West, mobilized maybe 500,000 more Ukrainian troops and took over the tactical and strategic running of those troops and caught the Russians off guard with insufficient troops in the weakest part of its line, which was in Kharkov in the north. And we know what happened. The Ukrainian army liberated most of the Kharkov province, but they came up against a wall once they got to the Donbass regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. Right. And the Russians then responded with the mobilization of their own over the winter. Remember that? So now the forces between the two sides are roughly even. You got maybe 500,000 in arms in both sides. And the Russians are dug in deep in defensive positions. And they have, in addition to that, air superiority advantage. and they have a 10-to-1 advantage in artillery. There's no way with a kind of even number of troops on both sides, Ukraine and on the front there in the east, there's no way that Ukraine defensive can succeed. You need at least a 5-to-1 advantage in troop numbers for an offensive to succeed. And then, you know, you can't do it with when you don't have air cover superiority and artillery at a disadvantage. I mean, this offensive is not, this is a political offensive to keep the goods flowing, the hardware and money flowing from the West, from NATO. There's no way they can prevail in this. They can't win this war. You know, but interestingly, Russia can't conquer Ukraine either. You know, Russia can't march across the eastern plains of Ukraine and take back all the land. Neither side has sufficient forces to launch a successful offensive. Russia has come to realize this, and Russia is settling in for a deep defense. So far, the Ukrainian offense, you know, hasn't even got to the main Russian line of defense there in the east, and it's got three lines of defense. They're just sort of tickling around what they call the gray zone before, you know, between both sides that no one's really occupying. So the Ukrainian offensive can't succeed, you know, because of simple principles of warfare. You know, this insufficient concentration of forces to be able to launch a successful offensive, and the Russians can't do it against the Ukrainians either. But the Russians are smart enough to settle into a deep defense and let the Ukrainians bash their heads against their stone wall and continue to wipe out thousands of Ukrainian troops. Well, in the first 2 weeks, I think the estimate is 13,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed, maybe one-tenth of that, 1,300 Russians. I mean, you can't sustain an offensive that way. But they'll continue the offensive until NATO has its meeting, I think July 12th, in Vilnius, Lithuania, to decide what to do next. Well, already you've got the Lithuanian president and the Polish president in a secret meeting here, unannounced, going to Kiev and meeting with Zelensky. What is that all about? Now, why in an announced meeting with these three presidents? Well, Poland has always had the interest on Western Ukraine. Western Ukraine was part of Poland for a long time. And I think what you're going to see, possibly, is you're going to see Polish forces and Lithuanian forces, maybe, coming into Western Ukraine as assisting troops. Assisting. They're not going to be on the front lines, but they're going to free up more Ukrainian troops to go to the Eastern Front. That's what it's all about. So there's another step in the escalation going on. It's quite obvious they got U.S. and U.K. special forces deeply involved in the fighting. Even U.S. generals here directing tactics here and running the equipment, you know, some of this equipment, surveillance equipment, so forth, drones, etc. You know, the Ukrainians are not trained on it. So the U.S. is deeply involved. NATO is deeply involved already. But we may see the next step here after July 12th, where some Polish troops will, clearly be sent to engage in non-combatant roles, the argument will be. Okay, so the point of all this is that Wagner's type of offensive warfare is no longer of use to the Russian military if its strategy is primarily defensive and let the Ukrainians bust their head against the defensive lines here and debilitate their military. And Russia's clearly playing a longer game, waiting to see what happens with the politics in and the U.S. in 2024. Russia's going to continue its strategy and hope that the Ukrainians keep coming, Ukrainian forces, and they'll keep destroying them until there is a change in the politics. This war will not be won on the plains of eastern Ukraine. These analogies to World War II, where you had these big tank and armored battles going back and forth across the plains and, of Russia and Ukraine, that does not apply in modern warfare. Slow-moving armor, whether it's motorized artillery or tanks or so forth, are just sitting ducks in modern military technology. It's so relatively easy to surveil and spot them and track them with smart missiles and bombs and so forth and eliminate them. You're not going to see those kind of battles anymore. The new technologies, are drone technology, smart missiles, smart bombs, surveillance of all kinds that didn't exist before. I would say the same, warships at sea. You're not going to see warships at sea fighting it out anymore. They're sitting ducks, too. That's why the Russian Navy has pulled way back from Ukraine. Anyway, that's my take on the Prigozhin. Prigozhin strategy, Wagner, is no longer useful. They were pulling the plug on Prigozhin. They did pull the plug. Prigozhin was looking at losing $2 billion a year. He, in desperation, made his move to get a deal, and he got one. Whether he stays in Belarus remains to be seen. They're certainly going to prosecute him in absentia, and no matter, he'll never be able to go back to Russia. Whether he gets to keep his money in the West, in Belarus, wherever, remains to be seen. But Prigozhin's rebellion is over. It did not weaken, in my opinion, Putin's regime. It strengthened it. Putin's got 80% popular support for what he's doing in Russia. And all the elite rallied around him. And we will see what actually happens. But Prigozhin's rebellion is over. Okay. Wow, I spent a lot more time talking about that than I thought I would. Let's get to this question of, is neoliberalism finished here? Define our terms here, as I've done many times and in my book here, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. There's an addendum that needs to be written about the current Biden regime, because Biden is following the neoliberal model. The question is that model breaking down? Well, let's look at the model. The model has to do with four areas of economic policy. Neoliberalism is actually a class-based economic strategy here that's proven quite successful over the last four decades. Kind of hit a wall with the 2008-9 crash. Obama tried to put it together. Really couldn't. It hit its high mark under George W. Bush. Right? Trump comes along and restored a few of its elements, but then COVID came and upended all that. And now we've got the end of COVID, and we've got, at least as an economic policy, and we've got right now, the Biden administration. Is Biden able, is he restoring neoliberalism? Well, neoliberalism, again, define our terms, fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is composed of government spending, that's social program, and defense spending. Right, and it's also about tax policy, and it's also about managing deficits and debt. That's fiscal policy. Three elements: government spending, taxes, and debt management, deficit and debt management. Well, how is the Biden administration performing in that sense? And, you know, fiscal policy, neoliberal, is increase the Pentagon and war spending and defense spending, right? Increase it. And don't worry about the budget deficit as a result. Neoliberal policy, fiscal policy, is cut corporate and business taxes. Don't worry about the impact on the budget and the deficit. And as far as managing the budget and the deficit is concerned, rely upon neoliberal policy, relies upon what's called the twin deficit solution. In other words, it relies upon money, that dollars that have gone offshore because of a trade deficit and or foreign investment, foreign direct investment by U.S. corporations, whatever, dollars flow offshore, accumulate offshore, and get recycled back to the U.S., the trade deficit, you know, which means the U.S. Buys more imports than it sells exports, creates a trade deficit. That means net money is flowing, dollars are flowing out of the U.S., right? That's the trade deficit. And you do that for four decades, a lot of dollars accumulate offshore. Well, the whole idea is the twin deficit is to have those sources that accumulated dollars, whether they're banks, central banks, or investors, to recycle those dollars back to the U.S. by buying U.S. treasuries. That's how the government has been able to finance its budget deficit. Budget deficit. Trade deficit generates the budget deficit solution, right? And that enables the U.S. capitalist elites and their government to keep cutting corporate taxes, which creates more of a deficit, and spending money on foreign wars, which also creates the deficit. You know, they try to reduce the deficit by cutting social programs, but that's not enough. So they rely on this recycling of the dollars coming back here to the U.S., to the Treasury, by buying Treasury bonds and so forth. Okay, those are the three elements of neoliberal fiscal policy. How have they fared under Biden? Well, we see a big increase in Pentagon and defense spending and war spending, you know, overseas contingency operations, OCOs. In addition, that's in addition to the Pentagon money, which went up $85 billion here this year, went up the year before, $85 billion. So, it's very much, Biden's policy is very much a fiscal neoliberal policy. Increase defense spending and cut social program spending. That's the other side of the coin of government spending fiscal policy. And he's doing that too, right? They had to throw money out there during COVID to keep the economy and society from collapsing. But now they're cutting it and they're coming back and doing what they do after a crisis, and that is to take back some of that social program spending that they engaged in. It's called austerity, in other words, right? The debt ceiling deal is a good example of just that. I'm going to go on details of the debt ceiling deal. I've talked about it before, but that's an example of social program cuts. And, of course, Biden's been eliminating step-by-step all of the COVID social programs. Here, the latest being the resumption of student debt payments on September 1st, and of course the child care and extended unemployment, and et cetera, right? I mean, he's been pulling the plug on all that. Now the debt ceiling deal, you know, more social program cuts, while defense and war spending go up. And taxes? Nothing. No increase in corporate business taxes going on. At the same time, he pushes through these three bills, which are corporate subsidy bills: the Infrastructure Act, in 2022. In other words, he takes the COVID money and he just moves it to corporations. The Infrastructure Act, the Semiconductor Chip and R&D Act, and the misnamed Inflation Reduction Act. Three acts, almost $2 trillion of government spending shifted and increased from COVID. Right? Well, this is very neoliberal. Very neoliberal in all its dimensions. Government spending, Pentagon up, so it's a program down, tax policies, no increase in taxes, right, for corporations. After Trump gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, don't touch that, right? And then of course we got the continued deficit. You know, before the debt ceiling deal, the deficit, the accumulation of the deficit is the national debt. That was $31.4 trillion. It's already $34 trillion, and it's going up to well over $40, $43 trillion here in the next 4 or 5 years. So it's very neoliberal. How far can this go? Well, that element of neoliberalism, fiscal neoliberalism, is going to reach contradictions and a crisis here, but it's not there yet. It's an intermediate term crisis of neoliberalism, the fiscal side. It's not imminent. What is imminent is neoliberal monetary policy. What is that? Very simply, the Fed keep interest rates low for a long period of time, free money for the banks and corporations, and that keeps the dollar very low, and the low dollar helps exports, right? But it also helps foreign U.S. corporations abroad repatriate their foreign profits by buying dollars. They can buy a lot more dollars when the dollar is low and bring their money, bring even more of their money back home, you see? So low interest rates, low dollar is neoliberal monetary policy. Well, that was a policy for quite some time, but it ran into the contradiction of rising inflation. So the Fed has had to shift and attempt to raise interest rates for the past year to try to do something about inflation. So it looks like it abandoned the free money approach. But no, it hasn't, you see, because the banking, regional banking crisis has resulted in another $1 trillion of free money being pushed into the economy by the Fed. $95 billion a week to fill the black hole of regional banks that are in trouble and losing their deposits. Yeah, the Fed and the FDIC, $5 billion a week at it. Well, that's neoliberal. Free money, throw the money at it, right? At the same time, they're raising interest rates, which aren't working too well. And the Fed, the neoliberal policy, is facing serious and immediate contradictions. And that is, if the Fed continues raising interest rates to try to slow inflation, and it's got to raise them to 7, 8%, I believe, to really have an impact on inflation, it's going to exacerbate the regional banking crisis, which is already a problem. It's a contradiction of major dimensions for neoliberalism. Raise rates more, you're going to precipitate a deeper recession, and, you know, you may be bringing inflation down a little bit more, but you're going to exacerbate the banking crisis, which is approaching a new phase here in the commercial real estate market by the end of the year. $1.7 trillion in loans for commercial real estate, offices, malls, and so forth, has to be refinanced and rolled over. A lot of those companies are not going to get refinanced by the banks because the banking crisis means the banks are cutting back their lending. So if these commercial offices and malls especially start going bankrupt, that's going to be reflected in losses on the balance sheets of these regional banks that are just limping along. So you've got a real contradiction in neoliberal monetary policy, which is the most serious weakness right now for neoliberal policy in general. So monetary policy, immediate contradiction, immediate negative situation. Fiscal policy, an intermediate crisis in fiscal policy. We don't know when that's going to be able to erupt here. What about industrial policy? Well, that's all about keep wages low, keep the unions tamed here. Don't raise minimum wages. Don't provide reform labor law, union labor reform. Don't allow strikes. Right. Cut back in benefits. All of that is very strong. Neoliberal industrial policy remains quite strong, and it's the strong element in the Biden neoliberal policy. Weak element monetary policy, weakening element fiscal policy, but strong industrial policy. Biden's first act in coming into Congress, coming into the presidency, what was it? Well, it was he met with the CEOs in the White House, and he guaranteed them there'd be no minimum wage hike under his regime here. Wages have been contracting here. Well, you know, you look at average wages, they're not contracting. Well, that's because the top 10-15% of the labor force is getting good raises in technology professionals and so forth, but the rest aren't. What about keeping the unions under the thumb? Well, no PRO Act, you know, labor law reform, even out of committee. Railroad workers were threatened with strike-breaking legislation, and we know how that went. Well, that's industrial policy, anti-union industrial policy. And this guy runs around saying he's pro-union and he's breaking strikes. Yeah. Western Longshore, they worked without a contract for a whole year here. Never did that before. They don't want to be the next target for anti-strike legislation. The Teamsters negotiations with UPS coming up, we'll see how that turns out. But, you know, as far as the class dominance here domestically and keeping the unions on the leash and keeping wages compressed, well, neoliberal industrial policy has been very successful here. There's no break in that. That brings us to the fourth element, which is external trade policy and the dollar. Well, we talked about the twin deficits. That's getting weak. That's getting weak. Why? China, they used to have over $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries, was recycling, is not doing it anymore. It's buying gold instead of buying U.S. treasuries. I think their cash of U.S. treasuries down to about $800 billion now and going further south. Trade war with China over tech, that's a continuation of neoliberal policy, but we don't know how that's going to turn out here. But the weakness here in the external, in other words, international scene, is the decline of the dollar, de-dollarization. The dollar as a reserve and as a trading currency is getting weaker and weaker, and alternatives are beginning to appear to the dollar. More and more countries are about to and are engaging in bilateral trade, not using the dollar, they're using their own currencies. The BRICS, which is a group of